Welcome back to our Razor's Edge series on the six secrets of champions, or the six paradoxes of champions. And we have got Toni Gaddy in studio with us. She's a clinical and performance psychologist, and she's been talking to us about what really makes a champion a champion. What I've realized, Toni, so first of all, welcome back.
Thank you, Alan.
What I've realized is that we actually haven't introduced you. And in the last podcast, you touched on certain parts of your past in terms of playing tennis. And you said, I didn't make it, you know, to Wimbledon. You started talking about that. But I've realized we actually haven't spoken about your journey as a champion. You were number one in South Africa in tennis. Just tell us quickly a little bit about your journey as a sports champion.
So it's interesting. My journey is so relevant for today's secret. So from very young, my dream was always to win Wimbledon. And immediately what comes to mind is my parents, because they encouraged that. We used to sit as a family watching Wimbledon. And both my sister and I had this dream of winning the doubles championships together. We were trained by our mother. And we moved our way gradually up to number one in South Africa at each of our age groups.
Both in doubles and singles?
In doubles and singles. Of course, in tennis, the numbers change depending on tournaments. But we were noted as top in South Africa, and then we got into the South African national squad, which then traveled the junior international tennis circuit, and then we all turned professional in that squad, and we started playing on the professional international women's circuit.
And where did you play? Which countries?
All over the world, from Europe, Italy, France, Germany, from Singapore, Taiwan, all over the United States. So there's a whole world out there. In every country, there are professional tennis tournaments. But the goal was to move toward the Grand Slams. And so we moved toward the qualifying of the Grand Slams. And the big goal was to qualify for the Grand Slams. And you will hear that I will speak about playing in the main draw of the Italian Open. That was one of the biggest breakthroughs. But it was so interesting, as I played on the pro circuit, I realized that there was stuff which I hadn't dealt with. And what was so fascinating is I only got to a ranking of the 400s in the world in singles and the 200s in the world in doubles. And my friends were making it to top 10. And this was just so intriguing for me. And so eventually I had to give up, because my ranking was just struggling out there in the 400s. And to make money in professional tennis, you have to be at least in the top 100. And so that is when I gave up. So it was a journey of from about 15, traveling the international circuit, doing homeschooling with managers and coaches with the South African team, essentially. And a journey from about 15 to about 22, trying to achieve my dream and our dream, if I bring my sister, Ricky Gaddy, into it. And eventually I had to accept the fact that I had failed. However, that failure really drove me to a passion bordering on obsession as to why my friends made it as champions and I did not.
Okay, so that's a good segue into today's third secret of champions. What is it?
So today's third secret is a champion gains self-belief by accepting self-doubt.
A champion gains self-belief by accepting self-doubt. Okay, let's go there. Go for it.
So it was so interesting, if we speak about the international professional tennis circuit, and I'm so glad you asked that question today because it's so relevant. One of my first experiences of a champion embracing and acknowledging and dealing with self-doubt was when my sister Ricky and I, we were about 200s in the world at the time, and we were playing the Italian Open, and we drew the number one seeds, the Maleva sisters. And this really got into the press because two sister teams were playing each other, and we were the underdogs, and they were the best in the world. And they interviewed, the Italian media interviewed both myself and my sister and the Maleva sisters. And my sister Ricky didn't want to speak to the press and said, Tony can speak. And they asked us if I was afraid or nervous about the next day's match. And I said, no, not at all. And then they asked, but aren't you afraid about two sister teams playing against each other? There's a lot of pressure. The focus is on the relationship. And I said, no, our relationship is just fine. And I didn't acknowledge any concern, doubt, worry about the next day playing the best in the world. Then they moved to the Maleva sisters, and there was a completely different response. The Maleva sisters, they asked the same questions. They shared how they were nervous, how it was incredible pressure playing against two sister teams, and how the sister relationship would be exposed under pressure. And they dealt with the fact that it was nerve-wracking playing against these underdogs from South Africa, and they were the best in the world. And they had to handle and deal with their doubt, their nerves, their anxiety, their relationship stuff off the court so that it does not bubble up on the court. Completely different to our response, which was in denial of self-doubt.
And of course, the result was...
We don't have to go there.
What did you lose by? You smashed or...
No, we were beaten very cleanly.
Okay.
6-1, 6-1.
Sure. So let's go back to this paradox, so to speak, about the self-doubt. Because, you know, self-doubt for many champions, for many entrepreneurs, can also be quite debilitating. You know, you can be like a deer in headlights with self-doubt. So there must be levels of self-doubt, or there must be a controlled framework around self-doubt.
So, I mean, that's an absolute good point. You can get stuck in self-doubt, your negative narrative inside your head that can just spiral you downwards into a deep, dark hole. And what's so important is the first step, which also brings me back to my first revelation of champions when I went back to interview some of my friends, best in the world and other world champions in other sports, is that they were very comfortable with having weakness, with not being extraordinary. They were comfortable with the fact that they had doubt in the first place, that they had fears. And I think that is the very first step, is that you have to know that it's okay to doubt. And when you feel it's okay to doubt, then it's much easier to move, to transition to how can I move away from this doubt. When you're accepting and easy about the fact that you can be vulnerable, then you can start looking at, okay, so what can I do to actually build strength, or look at the aspects of myself or this deal that might be positive, or what I'm doing that might be positive, or what I have gained, or what I have done so far. So you can only start looking at your strengths and your belief and your achievements once you have acknowledged that it's okay to make mistakes, have weaknesses, have failed.
I want to stick with the self-doubt side before we move to the other side of the paradox. The self-doubt, you use the term acknowledge self-doubt, which feels like I see you there, I recognize you, I acknowledge you, you're there, but I'm able to move from you, as opposed to my earlier question about sort of being stuck in it. Okay, so I mean, am I touching on something in terms of the language used about the word acknowledge self-doubt versus, immerse yourself in self-doubt? Maybe as another alternative, way to be in self-doubt, which is wrong.
Absolutely. That's an excellent question because it's so interesting. What comes to mind? I have this all champion start coming to mind as you're speaking. There's a famous tennis player. If you follow tennis, you will know her. Her name is Simona Halep. She's been number one in the world. She's won many, many Grand Slams. I think she's recently retired, actually. And she speaks about before big match, like a final of a Grand Slam, is that the doubts will emerge and she will acknowledge them and she'll feel them. And she, as a champion, would have built up a toolbox of how to deal with them, how to handle them, but she never indulges in them. And as human beings, we so easily can indulge in self-doubt because we want to magically have someone to appear to soothe us, so we feel the victim and we're hoping, we have this fantasy that someone will rescue us. But in fact, it's you that needs to be the rescuer. You have to have this relationship with your self-doubt so that it's your friend. You're gentle with your self-doubt, but you're also firm.
Yeah, I like that. I like the indulgence is too far. Acknowledgement is the right level of that relationship with self-doubt. And on the other side is not acknowledging. No relationship with self-doubt is bad. Okay, yeah. So that's sort of the extremes of the spectrum there. Let's move to the other side now. Let's look to go to self-belief now. If I think about self-belief, everyone talks about believing in yourself, and it's a quite cliched sayings, you've got to believe in yourself. But on a practical level, if somebody doesn't believe in themselves, by simply saying believe in yourself, you don't magically go, okay, now I believe in myself. What is the process that champions in all walks of life can use in order to move from a place of I don't believe in myself to I sort of believe in myself to I believe in myself? Just give us some pointers on how to actually journey to that point.
So before I do that, it's so important to note that so many clients, patients come to me and they think that the people who have succeeded already in their eyes just believe.
Mm-hmm.
That's the mistake I made.
Mm-hmm.
They don't just believe. They work so hard on self-belief. Or they have trained their mind to zoom in on what makes them feel strong, courageous, and boost their self-belief. So it's so important to note that it is a mind training, a way of focusing. It takes investment to have self-belief. So it's very important to note that.
So if I could say that in a different way. If you somebody is listening to this right now, watching this right now, and they don't have self-belief, that they could train themselves to get to that point.
Oh, 100%.
Okay.
There was a famous quote, and I think it was Arnold Schwarzenegger, who said, "If you believe." That you have 100%, or if you think you need 100% of self-belief 100% of the time, you're setting yourself up for failure.
So let's go back to my question around the steps to journey towards that point of self-belief. What do I need to do?
So I think what's so important is first be conscious or have the awareness that how you look at yourself in the moment and how you look at your past. So for example, an entrepreneur, if they are in the process of closing a deal, it's so important for them to be able to have the awareness of their strengths, what they bring to the deal, and what they're doing well in the deal. They have an awareness and an acknowledgement of their weaknesses, so that if it comes to the fore, they know how to fortify them, or they know how to refocus on their strengths. So that's as an entrepreneur in the moment. And that applies to every aspect of life. That self-awareness of amplifying the strong and minimizing the doubt, the struggle.
But still acknowledging it,
keeping it at the back of the mind. And there's tools to do that, as well as the way your mind space works.
Sorry to go off on a tangent here again and back to the self-doubt. But when you said that, I had this imagery of self-doubt as a personified and saying, you know, if you don't go, I see you, I recognize you, there you are, it starts to scream and then become loud. So just by acknowledging it and going, okay, there, I see you, it pacifies it so that you can focus on the strength.
You're literally reading my mind, because I have a concept in my work. It's a model, which I believe is so essential to growing self-belief.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called your little me and your great me.
Right.
And your little me is all your struggles, everything that makes you feel weak, bad, sad, mad. And your great me is everything about you that makes you feel strong, self-belief, courageous, bold, positive. And what I learned in my journey of becoming a champion, of studying the becoming a champion, is that every single champion who, I have to point out, is strong in most aspects of life, not only in the area of expertise. And well, that's a story for another day. They have the healthy relationship with their little me's. Mm-hmm. Because it's like their little child, like you spoke about. Mm. You need to acknowledge them, recognize them. And then sometimes you need to be gentle on your doubt, on your little me. And sometimes you have to be firm with him or her and say, enough, and refocus on what makes you feel strong.
Okay, let's go now back to the strong. Sorry to take you all over the place. So if I think about my journey, right, and I think about where my self-belief comes from, it's the amalgam of things that have happened. It's almost the balance sheet of all the successes I've had, because as all entrepreneurs, we have successes and we have failures, but you accumulate things. You accumulate a brand, you accumulate physical assets, you accumulate clients, you accumulate staff. There's this accumulation which becomes the proof set of, oh, it did work on the whole. So despite all the negative things that have happened over time, if I look back, I say, oh, it's actually built up. There is a trend. I started at zero and now I'm at 54, or whatever the case may be. And I did that, or I guided that, or I was a participant in that. And looking at that and acknowledging that goes, oh, I'm not so bad. Despite all the negative things that have happened, look at all the good things. Is that sort of what you're talking about now in terms of recognizing your strengths?
Absolutely. When I work with peak performers, it's so interesting. The ones who gain healthy momentum on success, as opposed to the ones who don't. And when I study peak performers, the ones who do gain that healthy momentum and success are able to really look back and see how far they've come on the journey, or different parts of the journey, what they've done, what is accumulating positively. Mm. They can absolutely acknowledge that and receive that and then build on that. If you can't see it, you don't have it. then if you can't see what you've achieved or you can't see your strength, you actually don't have it. Someone else might see it in you. But if you can't see it for yourself, you don't have that strength or even that achievement, and then you can't build on it. And then you can't move quicker and quicker or up and up to your next goal and your next goal, like we spoke about last week.
So if I take this to the extreme again and try and add some symmetry to this paradox, on the one side, there is I acknowledge you, I don't indulge you, of the self-doubt. On the success, there is I build my self-belief. But there is a point where you can become arrogant, where you move too far and you feel you're almighty, you're untouchable, invincible, which eventually leads to your downfall. So that's sort of the other extreme. Am I understanding that?
Absolutely. That's essential to speak about. I mean, we haven't really spoken about practical tools to build self-belief.
Okay.
If we have time, we'll do that later. But that is so important. And I have to refer to Roger Federer. So, of course, tennis is my love, or it was my love. Now I've tried to redefine myself. And so I'll speak about great tennis players often. Roger Federer was a perfect example of that. And he was a legend. And even though he won and he was doing so well, if you really go deep into his psyche and study his interviews and his books, or his book, you'll notice that while he was winning, he would win, but then he would continue to question, where does he still need to work? What are the others doing that he's not doing? What does he need to do more of? Where are his weaknesses? He never, ever felt so confident, so much self-belief that he could just rest on his laurels. He was constantly questioning himself, constantly looking at himself and growing, not only on the tennis court, but also off the court. Mm. He had an amazing mantra of keeping his feet on the ground. It came from his family, being incredibly humble, unimportant. I can't remember the exact quote, but it was all about you are never more important than the other, and always make the other, whoever the other is, feel more important than you.
Mm.
And you can imagine being Roger Federer and making other people feel that way.
Mm.
How incredibly admirable that was.
We've, of course, got time for those tools, because maybe we're creating some tension, you know, for the people. Give me the tools, give me the tools. So give me the tools.
Yeah, those tools are so important. And what's so important to understand is that every human being is so different. And that's what I've noticed with champions across the board in sport and all aspects of life. You've got to figure out what builds your self-belief. And just generically, tools that most people are familiar with or are easy to implement. And the first one, which so many people know about, but it is really undervalued, is act as if.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important to be able to play the role. If you don't believe, act like you believe, not only when you are in front of the deal that you want to close or performing in a match or whatever context you need that self-belief, but at home, act as if you are positive, happy, confident, because that role feeds into your body language, the way you feel, and that acting as if makes you feel like you actually start to believe in how you are acting. So that's very important. That's awesome. Number one.
Another way to say that is fake it till you make it.
Yes.
Same thing.
Same thing. Fake it till you make it.
Mm. Number two.
So number two would be, and also very underestimated. And I think these are underestimated because we read them often in these self-help books, is really visualizing that it's already done.
Mm-hmm.
So see what you want. Spend time getting clear on how you want to be in your business, your sport, your performance, and spend time getting clear about how your body language is, how you want to speak, how you conduct yourself, and visualize that end result. Visualize the outcome. Visualize what you want, and visualize other people congratulating you for that. So I think really spend time visualizing the outcome and notice what it feels in your body. It makes your body feel strong and positive.
Okay, and there's one more, number three. What is that?
Number three is very similar to what we've been speaking about, but it's really about when you can master this understanding that your self-doubt is actually your friend. It's actually there to show you where your weaknesses lie and where you need to build, where you need to fortify yourself, where you need to strengthen yourself. Then it becomes your guide of the work that you need to do in a very neutral, non-judgmental fashion. That's your guide of where you need to work, invest in, and then also have the ability to focus on your strengths. And that's where your self-belief gets mastered.
So if I had to title number three, it would be acknowledge self-doubt as your guide. Would that be the right title for point number three?
Yes, it's very much serves you. It shows you where you need practice, where you need to work hard. It shows you that you are getting too nervous, too angry, too sad, and that you need tools to deal with that. And the more you become familiar with your self-doubt, with your little me, the more over time you start to build tools which fortify your little me and then really enhance your self-belief.
Well, Tony Getty, thanks so much for being on Razor's Edge on this series here, The 6 Secrets of Champions. And if you are enjoying this, stay tuned for our next episode, which will be entitled
A Champion Relies on Him or Herself Completely, but Also Relies on Others.
Great. Thanks once again for being in studio, and we will see you next time.